May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, your honors, counsel, Jeff Genelotti on behalf of the appellant. Your honor, this is our, at the outset, may I reserve 7 minutes of rebuttal time before I get started? This is our second opportunity to be in this court on this issue in this case. A panel of your honors may recall having been here before. This is an automobile insurance reformation case. And I recall the court's commentary last time that the court was well familiar with the facts of the case as well as the law, which I would submit is fairly established in the arena of reformation. So I'd like to hop right in to the lower court's rulings, if I may, and talk about where I think the lower court got it wrong.
Please.
Number one, I think the issue the court needs to address, having looked at the briefs and hearing the argument after today, is whether the factual findings made by the lower court were correct. And I submit the answer to that is no. I'll talk about that in a second. And the second issue is whether the trial court correctly applied the law to those facts and factual findings. The court made multiple factual findings, and I'll say at the outset that where I think the court got it wrong, and I'm going to list these in order. These are in the lower court's opinion, beginning at A104 and A105 of the appendix. There's seven factors enumerated by the court that it relied upon in totality in ultimately concluding that the insurer had made a meaningful offer. Number six, I think, was the lower court's most critical error. And number six, the lower court, and I'm quoting verbatim, Ms. Purnell Charleston acknowledged that Mr. Redstone did review some information with her on his computer screen, which is consistent with Mr. Redstone's testimony regarding his standard practice. It's critical, Your Honor, and it's wrong. Ms. Purnell Charleston didn't, at no point in the record, acknowledge that she viewed the computer screen. And there's dialogue contained in her deposition testimony, and she testified consistently at trial. And basically the substance of that, which is at page A81 of the appendix, is that she did not recall seeing the computer screen. And my opponent questioned her vigorously over a series of five or six questions, trying to elicit a response that, is it possible that you saw it? And she never answered that in the affirmative. Instead, her answer was, I don't recall ever seeing it.
Does that mean she did not recall seeing a computer or did not recall seeing the UM-UIM offer or somewhere in between?
I think what it means, Your Honor, is that she did not recall seeing a computer, if you read her language, which in turn would follow that she didn't see the computer screen, did not see any of the various different coverages and corresponding premiums that were explained to her, as Mr. Redstone would have you believe. And the reason it's so important in the case is because that computer screen, in terms of the insurer's burden to make a meaningful offer, was the only mechanism used by Mr. Redstone to show her different coverages and different rates. As a panel of the court may recall, as part of the Form A, which is also part of the court's appendix.
If we uphold that finding, number six, what result?
In other words, Your Honor, if the court believes that she saw the computer screen?
If we find that the court correctly found that particular fact, does the appeal turn on that?
No, Your Honor, because I think even if you found that she saw the computer screen, we don't know what was on the computer screen. And Mr. Redstone admitted that he had no recollection of the meeting with Ms. Purnell Charles.
So you're saying it's a critical fact, but not so critical that the appeal turns on it?
Well, I think it's the most critical factor, Your Honor, because if the court finds that Ms. Purnell Charleston never saw the computer screen, or we can't definitively decide whether she saw the computer screen, then at that point we know that she didn't see any of the premiums that are a prerequisite to making a meaningful offer.
What I understand to have occurred, she was asked, did he show you the computer at any point? Her answer is, I don't recall. Then the question is, that's what I'm trying to figure, is that you don't remember? Answer, I don't remember him showing me. My question is, do you think he did not show it to you? And she says, rather less than definitively, it's possible he didn't. Now, if the trial judge hears the witness say it's possible he didn't, is it an unreasonable inference that it's possible he did, particularly when he testifies before that same judge that it was his practice to show the computer screen? what do we use to say to that trial judge, you who have seen both witnesses testify, and you've heard one say he showed the screen because it's his practice to do so, even though he may not have an independent recollection of it, and the other witness says it's possible he didn't. Why is the trial judge not free to draw whatever inference he wishes from that mishmash and conclude that it's more likely than not that she was shown the computer screen?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I don't think it's an unreasonable inference, but I think that the issue is, as I said, even if the court draws the inference, as the lower court did, that she it's possible that she saw the computer screen, it's the burden is still on the insurer to demonstrate that what was on that computer screen was tantamount and sufficient to establish a meaningful offer of insurance. And as I said, the only thing on that, the computer screen was the only thing that Mr. Redstone did that day that contained any premium or rate structure. It was the only thing. He admitted that he did not use the grid, which was the back of the
phone. Well, the only thing I wanted to make clear in my mind is her equivocal answer to that question does not establish as a matter of fact that she was not shown the computer screen, correct?
I think that's right. I think that's right, but I think it goes a step beyond that, as I've pointed out, in terms of whether the insurer can establish what was on it. And that leads us to the second point where I think the court erred, and that's factor number three in the court's opinion, and that is what I would submit to the court was a misapplication or giving undue deference to the law and custom and habit. The law and custom and habit, I would submit, is clear in Delaware. The Patilla decision speaks to that. And I think the lower court improperly applied the factual findings to the law on that issue. We know that the law says custom and habit in and of itself is not enough. What is the
basis for that conclusion that custom and habit in and of itself is not enough?
Well, custom and habit, Your Honor, is basically that it's speculation, it's assumption, and in a case like this where there's an obligation to make a clear and equivocal offer to say that I did it this time because I did it on all prior occasions.
Is it just in insurance cases that it's not enough, or is it also not enough in any case?
Well, I don't know that I'd say in any case, but as I made the analogy last time to this court, if it was a motor vehicle negligence case, and I was testifying from the stand, and I said, I know that I put my left blinker on in this case, even though I don't remember putting it on before I turned in front of the other driver, because I always put my left blinker on, and I'd submit in that case it's not enough. And I submit the law says within the Reformation context, in the arena of Reformation, it's not enough.
Is the law clear that there is a distinction between the custom and practice, or a better word, the protocols of an insurance carrier, as opposed to the custom and practice of the individual agent as he deals directly face-to-face with customers? Is that a meaningful distinction?
I don't believe there's any distinction, Your Honor. And I don't think the law as it stands speaks to that.
Is it logical to draw that kind of distinction?
I don't believe it is, and I believe that's where the lower court got it wrong, Your Honor. I believe that the custom and practice of Mr. Redstone, as he testified, was the custom and practice of the Hartle Agency, as I would argue to the court, is the custom and practice of the corporate defendant, State Farm. It's an insurance agent. By virtue of the agency relationship, Mr. Redstone's custom and practice is that of the company. And the reason that I think there's no distinction is that what the case law speaks to is whether, and what Judge Sleitz found was whether Mr. Redstone, in this case because it was a face-to-face meeting with the appellant, could speak to a specific interaction with that individual. Unlike cases where it was a corporate level or agency level manager saying, this is what we always do. There's no difference in this case because when you focus on that specific interaction language, Mr. Redstone himself, not unlike the corporate level agency manager, can't speak to a specific interaction with Ms. Purnell Charleston. That's undisputed. He's told us that.
I'm having trouble following the thrust of your argument. It seems to be that the agent never discussed any particular insurance coverage or any particular price, and that your client simply walked out and had a new policy with a new price. Now, that defies logic. So if we assume that they must have discussed policy limits and price, The question is, what type of evidence do you put in to prove it? And is it your position they didn't present any evidence that they discussed anything, or simply they didn't present evidence on the uninsured motorist coverage?
That's correct, Your Honor, your latter statement, and that is the record supports the fact, or at least my client's recollection, as vague as it was, and ultimately the trial judge found that basically Mr. Redstone nor my client had a sufficient enough recollection of the events. But what the record shows is that she recalls vaguely Mr. Redstone discussing various coverages with her, bodily injury liability, collision, no-fault insurance, or PIP, but that he did not discuss with her the notion of uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage, nor did he review different levels of coverage, nor did he tell her that she had the right to match her liability coverage, and nor did he discuss premiums with her.
So her testimony was she remembered discussing everything except the coverage that's critical to this particular case.
That's right.
And the agent said, when I discuss everything, I also discuss uninsured motorist coverage because that's my practice. And the Superior Court resolved that credibility dispute in favor of the insurance company.
That's right, Your Honor, but I don't think that the court can reach its conclusion where the burden of proof rests with the insurer to basically back into its conclusion on a credibility issue. The custom and habit, Mr. Redstone, in the record, nowhere does he say, I recall or I can show you or I can demonstrate or meet my burden of proof by demonstrating that I explained uninsured, underinsured, I offered her the limits equal to her liability, and I showed her the premium. He can't do it. He can only do it through custom and habit.
Well, the burden of proof means only that if the evidence on a certain disputed factual point is in equipoise, the party with the burden of proof loses. So in what way was the evidence in equipoise?
It
appears that the court found that the plaintiff's testimony on this point was not credible, and so the court discounted it. And that, the evidence that the court relied on all came from the other side, that is, from Mr. Redstone. Why wasn't that evidence, even though it may not be as airtight as one would like, sufficient to meet the burden?
Because there's nothing about her lack of credibility. And what I said to the court, frankly, Your Honor, I think whether Judge Slights at the lower court level found her to be credible or non-credible, that doesn't go to the issue. The insurer first has to establish that it made a meaningful offer, and they simply cannot do it before you get to her credibility. What Judge Slights did, if Your Honors will recall, is he, in my opinion, applied a totality of the factors or circumstances approach to say, when you put these seven things together, and I would submit he's got three or four of them wrong at the lower court level or unsupported by the evidence, that I find, and there's an undertone of lack of credibility, that the meaningful offer was made. And I don't think you can get there. I don't think there's any evidence of record if you take custom and habit, and if this court believes that there's no difference between the custom and habit of Mr. Redstone and that of a corporate level manager, I think the law is clear.
Let me put it differently. Sure. You got the plaintiff herself testifying that she had been advised of all of the coverage options, all of them, except for this one, which happens to be the one in dispute. Why couldn't the court conclude that that is highly improbable and conclude from her own testimony that, in fact, she was told about all the options, including the one that's at issue here?
Well, and I think that's exactly what the lower court concluded, obviously, Your Honor.
If that's what the lower court did, where's the reversible error?
Because I think the lower court ignored the standard backdrop against which Mr. Redstone was explaining and reviewing these coverages. For instance, look at the Form A. I mean, I would suggest that the manner in which the Form A was presented, which encompassed uninsured motorist coverage, was completed in a less than airtight fashion. For instance, the appellant, as instructed by Mr. Redstone, signed in the wrong spot. She signed under an assigned risk part of the Form A, which we know she wasn't assigned risk. He admitted that and admitted that he never reviewed the form after she gave it back to him. Mr. Redstone completed the entire Form A. It was all his handwriting. He admitted that. he was the one that checked the box for minimum limits, but yet never carried those limits over to the blank line on the Form A to reflect $15,000/$30,000. He did not use the rate chart, and then he told me it wasn't part of his custom and practice, as much as he wanted me to rely upon his custom and practice, to read or review the paragraph relating to the selection of uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage with her. It's right on the Form A. And he was right across the table from her, allegedly, but never read that to her and told me that wasn't part of his custom and practice. So I would suggest he was picking and choosing what things or those things that were part of his custom and practice.
What incentive does an insurance agent have not to convince the prospective client to buy as much coverage as possible?
Your Honor, I recall that as an issue from last time, and I think there's every business incentive not to. On one side of
it, for an agent as opposed to the carrier.
I understand. For an agent to do it on behalf of the company, you're selling a lower limit of insurance. So in this case, they sold her a $15,000/$30,000 UM policy that effectively we now know is of no benefit. It's no good to her. They minimize their risk from a business standpoint. They minimize their exposure.
Yeah, you say they. That's the insurance carrier. An insurance agent's paid based on a percentage of premium collected, isn't he?
Well, I don't know that we know that entirely, Your Honor. I believe that there would be an argument to be made that they could be paid based upon, as a global effort, selling policies, minimal or more minimal policies, that ultimately curb or restrict the insurance carrier's exposure in the case. We don't know whether there's incentive like that. But I would suggest to you that there's business
incentive. We're not allowed to just be intuitively logical?
To sell higher limits?
To sell at a higher premium if you're paid on the basis of the premium.
I don't know that that is. I mean, I think that at first glance it says more premium, more money, but we don't know what internal incentive there is between State Farm and agent or carrier and agent to say if you sell minimum limits policies, we know that on the global whole, our risk is suppressed to a far greater amount than if you're selling 100, 300 policies. So I think there's an incentive there. I think from...
Can I ask you to come at it from a different perspective?
Sure.
Tell me, within the framework of this type of an interaction where a person comes in and it's on the computer screen, whether anybody shows it to anybody or not, but that's where the current rates are kept and there's this Form A and that's in writing and all that, what would the insurance agent have to do in order to not have there be any question about whether a meaningful offer was made? What other steps besides what was done here?
Well, I think it's simple, Your Honor. I think in the technological age in which we live, that if you're going to use computer screens, we don't send packets of paper as often anymore. There's no paperwork with four corners of ink. That in this particular case, if he did what he claimed he did, and he showed her various layers of coverage with various premiums, you hit a print button. You hit a print button, and you ask her to sign the bottom of it, and you attach it to the Form A, and you put it in the file. Or you have her sign off on one of those electronic or credit card readers that we use when we go to Walgreens or Happy Harry's, and you use your credit card, and you sign the box. That goes to the computer, and then that screen could have been archived or saved somewhere. My colleague would have you know, the argument made in the briefs is that it puts an onerous burden on the insurance carriers because these things can come along 3, 4, 5 years down the road. It doesn't do that. We live in a technological society. All that had to be done was Mr. Redstone had to have the capability to print. And I think this is the court's opportunity to button up or bring existing UM UIM law current to basically more clearly define what the carrier's obligation is. There's strong public policy.
Wouldn't that be a legislative function? For instance, the requirement that it must be rejected in writing. Shouldn't that be in the statute as opposed to paper?
Well, I don't even know, Your Honor, that I'm saying that it has to be rejected in writing. In response to the Justice's question, I was just saying if you wanted to make it airtight, that may be legislative. But certainly to be able to say, this was exactly what I showed her that day on the computer screen. These were the different coverages. It was printed and put in the file so that Mr. Redstone or whoever the agent was could later come back to it or bring those things from archive. And we know from the discovery and from the record that they don't have the ability to do that. So what we don't know is, and we'll never know, is what was on that computer screen.
Well, your argument really goes to the point of having conclusive evidence. And this case turns on circumstantial evidence. Now, if we go back to Form A, what the Superior Court said is Form A was signed maybe in the wrong place, but there was an election of lower coverage. And there's a footnote that says Form A is not dispositive, but Form A is indicative of the fact that uninsured motorist coverage was discussed. And then the court goes on to talk about other facts to come up with this totality, this evidence argument. What's wrong with that?
Well, because I think, Your Honor, as I say in the briefs and argued to a panel of this court last time, is putting it all together still does not get the carrier over its burden of establishing a clear and unequivocal meaningful offer was made. There's inference in those factors that the court drew that she was trying to save money because every coverage from her predecessor carrier was now lower with State Farm in this case. Well, that's great.
You take the clear and unequivocal language from a case? Or just the meaningful offer language?
The meaningful offer language, Your Honor.
It's clear and unequivocal. Sounds like Justice Holland's point about conclusive evidence.
Yeah, the meaningful offer language is from a case, obviously. We know there's an obligation under Morris in the Arms case to make a meaningful offer.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I do, Your Honor, but the last point I'd make is that I think the legislative or statutory intent is to ensure that individuals like my client understand what's being explained to them. And we know from Mr. Redstone's own testimony that certain things about what he did with the Form A, I would suggest, are inadequate to ensure. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Colin Schalk here on behalf of State Farm. Your Honor, Judge Slates did not plow any new ground in this case. What he did as the finder of fact and as the decider of the law was put everything together, and he was given adequate information to do that. Before the trial started, the parties stipulated to the facts. We submitted memos of law. We had the trial in July of 2011. The judge issued some oral findings of fact. There was actually some post-trial briefing. And then, in August 2011, the judge issued the decision finding in favor of State Farm that it met its burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence. The Habit Rule is Rule 406. And the Habit Rule, DRE 406, doesn't require there to be any particular evidence or law. It's simply the mere fact that there is evidence. I'll read it out loud. Evidence of the habit of a person or the routine practice of an organization, whether corroborated or not, and regardless of the presence of eyewitnesses, is relevant to prove that the conduct of the person or organization on a particular occasion was in conformity with the habit or routine practice. And there's also the standard jury instruction for direct or circumstantial evidence, 23.1. What we know for a fact is that on May the 14th, 2007, the plaintiff and Mr. Redstone met at the Hartle Agency for the sole purpose of the plaintiff purchasing insurance from State Farm. There was no other purpose. We also know that by the end of the meeting, there was a Form A that was provided to the plaintiff. She signed the Form A, dated on May 14, 2007, and as a result of that, State Farm issued insurance and the coverage amounts listed in the Form A.
Could I stop you right there?
Yes, ma'am.
Would you agree that if all you had on your side was a signed Form A that listed all of the coverage, that would not satisfy your burden of showing a meaningful offer?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so if that doesn't cut it, why should that fact be given weight in determining whether there was a meaningful offer or not?
Because, Your Honor, as Judge Slice says, it fits into the mix of the evidence. It's not dispositive, but it's part of the evidence. And it's part of the circumstantial evidence which establishes that Mr. Redstone did what he typically did. Mr. Redstone
tested. Well, wait a second. The Form A has nothing to do with whether there was something on the computer screen, does it?
Well, it does, because that's where the information from the Form A came to put onto the Form A, Your Honor. Mr. Redstone testified that he takes all the information from the computer screen and puts it onto the Form A. In fact, Your Honor, the computer actually selects the insurance company to which the coverage will be applied. It could be State Farm Mutual, or it could be State Farm Fire and Casualty. He didn't pick the company. The computer did. As evidence, he must have used the computer because he chose it from the computer itself. So, yes, I do think it's part of the mix.
I do think
it shows that he used the computer.
I'm a little confused by that answer. In response to earlier questions, Mr. Gentilotti said that the way to prove, to have airtight conclusive proof, is to hit the print button so that whatever's in the computer will be in hard copy and then have the prospective insured sign that hard copy. And your response to Justice Berger's question suggests that that's what happened here.
No, Your Honor. If I said that, I don't think that I did. That's not certainly what I meant.
Okay.
What I meant was Mr. Gentilotti seems to be disputing the fact that Mr. Redstone even used a computer. All that I'm saying is that he took information from the plaintiff, put it into the computer, and when asked how he chose one particular insurance company as opposed to another, because there were two State Farm companies involved, State Farm Fire and Casualty and State Farm Mutual, he said that I put the information in the computer and the computer chose the particular company. The point I'm making is a more basic one. He clearly had to have used the computer because it decided which company to use. That's the point I was trying to make.
What exactly is the legal issue that we need to decide as you see it?
Your Honor, I said it at the beginning of the brief, whether the judge made any errors of law and whether the decision of Judge Slice was met by competent substantial evidence. One thing that's unique about this case is this case had actually been tried by a jury. Once the judge issued the jury instructions, the jury would have decided one way or the other. It would have issued no findings of fact at all. In this particular case, since the Judge Slice tried it as a bench trial, he issued findings of fact. He made credibility determinations. So I don't see that, absent any mistake of law, and I'm not clear that Mr. Gentilotti pointed any mistakes of law out.
I'm asking what the legal issue is. Are you saying there is no legal issue?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not clear that anybody's pointed any out. He decided the law. He decided the case based upon the law as it exists in this state.
Well, let me point one out to you as a possibility and tell me whether it is an issue of law or not. There seems to be some discussion in the briefs and past case law that the custom and practice or the habit of an insurance carrier, the way in which they instruct their agents to act on the issue of a meaningful offer of underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage, is not relevant to whether they gave a meaningful offer or not. Is there a distinction between that and the custom, practice, habit of an individual agent who testifies in a given situation that he was with the insured, it was his practice to follow the steps that he indicates, and that while he doesn't have an independent recollection, he believes he would have done so in this case. Is that a legal issue here about whether the individual agent's custom and practice is admissible for the purpose of being in the totality of the mix to determine a meaningful offer?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think it's largely a factual question. It's a legal issue, too, because this court and the Superior Court on prior occasions has rejected the notion that if there's a standard in the industry or a standard for that company, that filtered down to the individual agent and filtered down to that particular insured. Usually it happens where you try to upsell the coverage, where a person has said, where somebody from the insurance company says, we instruct all of our agents to upsell the coverage, they must have done it here. Or that we tell all our agents to do a particular thing. I think in that case it isn't sufficient, and the Superior Court has concluded on prior occasions it's just not sufficient. In this particular case, knowing what I knew, I spoke to Mr. Redstone. I offered him as a witness. He was deposed by the plaintiff, so everybody knew going into the trial what he was going to say. And his testimony was clear that he, in particular, based upon his own experience as an agent and based upon his own understanding of what he had to do, did in fact offer the additional coverage because that is what he did time after time after time. And he said all the time. In fact, that's what I questioned. I asked him, do you always do that? And the answer was yes. So there is a distinction.
I understand, Mr. Schalk, the precise legal rule that the Superior Court has previously applied. Is it custom and practice alone is insufficient to defeat a motion for summary judgment, or is not sufficient to defeat a motion for summary judgment, or does it have a trial context? Does the rule have a trial context?
Your Honor, I know that there was a prior decision by, I believe it was Judge Chandler in the Bryan versus Federal Kemper case, where he denied a motion for summary judgment because he said that the agent could, in fact, make an oral offer, but there wasn't sufficient proof at that point based upon the standards applicable to summary judgment that it hadn't met its burden of proof, because if you interpret the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, you couldn't win that case. So as a summary judgment issue, the offer may not have been sufficient, and as a summary judgment issue, practice may not have been sufficient if you interpret the facts against the non-moving party. In this particular case here, that wasn't the standard. Judge Slice was finding fact. So based upon the facts that he found, the oral offer was present. It was present based upon the custom and practice. And it was based upon circumstantial evidence.
So is it your position that at a trial, custom and practice is sufficient to rule in favor of the carrier?
Yes, Your Honor.
But let me make sure I'm clear on this. Custom and practice of the individual agent who has a protocol that he follows, even though he doesn't remember whether on this particular occasion he followed it, but he's confident that he did because he customarily does, as distinct from some State Farm headquarters protocol that's sent out to all their agents in the field. Is there a distinction there? Is there a role for us to play in making that distinction in any opinion that comes out of this court?
If the court chooses to make that decision based upon a larger scope of the case, I can't argue against it, Your Honor. All I went for this particular case, I know based upon the evidence that Mr. Redstone has testified that that was his practice. I don't know that the court has to go any further than that. If you just look at him and say that's his practice, because keep in mind, it was his practice when he was with Nationwide too, and as a State Farm agent, he knew that. So did State Farm give him that instruction? I believe that it did, but there was no evidence in the record to that effect. It was simply that he knew, based upon his own experience, that he had to do that.
Just
I think that's all the court needs to rule.
Just to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, is there any evidence in the record of either a company-wide practice in that regard or an industry-wide practice? Or is all we have here the evidence of the agent's practice?
Yes, sir. Now, he testified that he was trained to do that. Now, whether that came from Nationwide or State Farm, I didn't think was important to the evidence at the trial. But there is no evidence in this case of any industry-wide standard or State Farm general standard. I didn't call a witness to that. I guess what I got to the point was I was thinking of him as the frontline soldier. He was the first person over the ramparts. He was the person who had to speak to the insured. Once I was clear that he knew, he was the witness that I called. And to get back to Ms. Purnell Charleston, I think her credibility was poor. And I think Judge Slice decided that. When I asked her the questions, because I called her as part of my own case in chief, when I asked her questions about the coverages that she said she was offered and about the lack of any contact about the uninsured motorist coverage, I knew what the answer was going to be because I deposed her. I didn't call her affirmatively to prove that the coverage was offered. I called her because I knew that her credibility was poor at that point. There was simply no reason for an agent to be discussing all of the other coverages and to leave that one unsaid. So that's why I called her.
Well, let me stop you right there. I thought the whole reason we have this problem, if you want to call it a problem, is because agents don't always include the uninsured motorist component when they are reviewing each of the coverages that somebody has selected. So it is required that there be a meaningful offer of that specific coverage. And testimony that says, oh, I put everything on the computer screen and I go through all the coverages, when the Form A just has a check mark that she didn't even look at, how is that supposed to be a meaningful offer with respect to the UM portion of the coverage.
Your Honor, when this court first dealt with the issue back in 1984, the Arms versus State Farm case, there was simply no obligation to do anything in particular other than what the statute says. All the statute says is you must offer the coverage. What you had to do was left unsaid. And then what the consequence was left unsaid. The Arms court said you have to offer the coverage, and the consequence is that if you don't, it remains a continuing offer. The Morris versus Allstate court a few years later, and it wasn't very long later, said, well, in addition to offering the coverage, it must be meaningful. You must explain the cost. You must explain it in a clear fashion, and you must explain it with the same manner and same emphasis. The decisions subsequent to that really don't go too much into that concept. The decisions usually involve USAA, Hartford, or Progressive, because most of those companies don't actually have face-to-face meetings with their insureds. They send packets. And the decisions revolving around the manner and the emphasis really deal with the packet type information, where it's buried somewhere on page 40 of a 47-page packet. And I believe that was actually one of the cases where it wasn't a 47-page packet. Then the decisions revolve around when there's a change in the policy. Was it a significant change which requires a reoffer? The basic concept that's before the court today is really the Morris versus Allstate concept from either 1986 or 1987. Did you explain it? To what Mr. Genelotti said here is that you should require the print screen to be printed and signed. That would be a first for this court, because the court has, over the course of time, from 1984 until recently, always said this is what is insufficient, this is what you have to do. What Mr. Genelotti is saying, this is the first time the court should rule what you actually have to do.
Okay. Setting that aside in terms of a rule about printing up what's on the computer and all that, the law says you have to offer the coverage.
Yes, ma'am.
And the court has said it has to be a meaningful offer. The fact that it has to be a meaningful offer, doesn't that carry with it the concept that simply being able to show that somewhere on some papers I have all this information and it's my policy to always show everybody all this information is perhaps enough to show that there was an offer, but not enough to show that there was a meaningful offer?
Your Honor, with due respect to the court, I think that places too much emphasis on the word meaning or takes it too far. If you have explained that you're entitled to a certain type of coverage, you've explained what the coverage is, and then you tell them it's going to cost you this.
But wait a second. The problem is that we've got some pretty fuzzy facts here in terms of what actually took place. So the trial court apparently said, well, neither side is sure what happened, and I agree, I'm accepting that neither side remembers what actually happened. So now I'm stuck with a form, which clearly is insufficient. And I also think that the policyholder was looking for a low price, so that's part of why I think an offer was made, which I don't follow the logic on that. But anyhow, but basically what the court says is, I've got nothing else, so I'm going to say that since the adjuster said that he typically does this, that this is his custom and practice, that's going to not only qualify that he made an offer, but that he made a meaningful offer.
But there's a distinction I'm not grasping, Your Honor, and that is the meaningful offer in the past, to my knowledge, means you have to tell them that you have a right to purchase the coverage between the what you have and what you could have if you purchased equal limits. And I'm not clear that the word meaning says that you have to actually go into the case law or go into the policy or do anything more than tell them what it is you're purchasing and what you will cost you and what it's all about. I mean, I don't know what else you would do. I'm not sure what the agent would, if he recalled the conversation, if he said, I remember her being there that day, based upon Your Honor's questions, I'm not clear what he would have said if he recalled the conversation that would have made the offer meaningful, as Your Honor refers to. I'm not clear what that means.
Well, and I guess that's part of my problem, too, in the sense that if the insurance agent had said, I remember this meeting because it was my daughter's birthday, or whatever reason I actually remember it, and I followed my custom, and I went through everything on the screen, including the UIM coverage and how much it would cost, and then I filled out the form because she rejected that.
All right.
That would be evidence. That would be pretty clear.
But it doesn't make
evidence.
It meaningful, Your Honor. That's my point. If you remembered everything that Your Honor just said, as opposed to what he said he would typically do, they're the same thing. One he remembers, one he does not. One is practice and habit, and one is an actual memory. But I don't know that context makes one more meaningful than the other. It's an evidentiary issue. It's a problem that State Farm would have in meeting its burden of proof. But if he did those things, those two things don't make, one makes it meaningful and the other one does not. I guess that's my point, Your Honor.
On the evidentiary issue, the other side has raised point number six in Judge Slice's opinion. It's just plain wrong. Was there an acknowledgement by Ms. Grinnell Charleston that Mr. Redstone did review some information with her on his computer screen?
Your Honor, I go to the same point that Chief Justice Steele made, which is I pressed the plaintiff on that point. She never acknowledged that she saw it. She never acknowledged that she didn't. To say affirmatively and positively that she said that, I'm not going to agree with that. Because I'm not going to say that Judge Slice was so correct in that point that that was clearly so. On the other hand,
if
I don't
think... If he made a mistake in saying that, why does that not require a reversal because of an important fact being clearly wrong?
Because it doesn't make any difference, Your Honor. The plaintiff, I'm sorry, Mr. Redstone testified that he showed her the computer screen. Her lack of acknowledgement is not an affirmative statement that she didn't see the computer screen. He testified that he showed it to her. He testified that he always shows it to her. And as I said earlier, Your Honor, in response to a question from the court, the fact is the computer picked the particular insurance company to which it would be applied. That's where he got all the information. And these days, that's not hard to understand, Your Honor. When we all do our work, we refer to computer screens. We use less paper than we did. His testimony, he always uses a computer screen. You can debate, or the court can debate, whether in fact he used it to show to her. But the fact that he used one, I think, is undebatable.
Okay, so notwithstanding the error in saying she acknowledged it, the evidence is still legally sufficient.
Yes, sir. It makes no difference to how this case turned out in any way, shape, or form. It was based upon the practice of habit. It was based upon circumstantial evidence. It was based upon what Mr. Redstone said. It was based upon the Form A, which clearly showed all of the things being discussed in one shape or another. And in large measure, it was based upon the lack of credibility of the plaintiff. I called her affirmatively to establish that lack of credibility. And I called her because I knew she would deny that she ever had any discussion of the UM coverage. And of course, that made no sense under the context. I also called her to testify that all of her coverages with State Farm were less than they were with USAA. And there had to be a reason for that. I also called her to testify that essentially she was on disability at the time because of the ER report that very day and a doctor's note a week later, both of which said that she was on disability and unemployed, to establish that she had a reason to get less coverage than she had. So the things that she said were no surprise to me. I called her for that purpose. I think the totality of the circumstances, or what Judge Slice called the mix of the evidence, establishes that. But the other point, Your Honor, is that is there a reason to reverse Judge Slice? The decision was made by Judge Slice based upon the law, and I don't see any legal error in what was said, and I'm not sure that Mr. Genelotti identified any.
Let me make sure I understand your argument. As I understand it, the agent testified, my custom and practice would be to discuss, we'll say, A, B, C, and D, and that's what I did. And the record would support a conclusion that D was the uninsured motorist coverage and that if he followed his custom and practice, it would be a meaningful offer.
Yes, sir.
Her testimony is, I remember A, B, and C, but I don't remember D. So the question isn't whether his normal custom and practice would constitute a meaningful offer. The question is, did he do it? And she says, I don't remember. And your argument is, well, if we look at the objective evidence into the equation, we have support for his position about using a computer screen, because when he transferred the information from the screen to Form A, which was the name of the company, he also transferred the other information, which is consistent with him following his custom. And if he followed his custom, and it's undisputed the custom is meaningful, that's the end of the case.
That's pretty much it, Your Honor. And the judge made a decision. Is there evidence in the record for which the court should reverse it? And since the State Farm is the appellee and not the appellant, I'm suggesting to the court that there is no evidence sufficient to reverse anything that Judge Slates did. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Briefly.
On that point, before you start, are you disputing the fact that I understand your position on custom and practice, and I'm not commenting on that. My question is, based on what he said his custom and practice was, would it constitute a meaningful offer?
If we assume what Mr. Redstone said?
Yeah, if he said, this is what I normally do, this is what I did here. But if we just say, look at what he said, this is what I normally do, do you disagree that if he did what he normally did, it would constitute a meaningful offer? It's just in this case, your contention is he can't prove he did it.
That's right, Your Honor. I mean, it puts a credibility issue in the lap of Mr. Redstone to say...
Suppose he did do it. Suppose the court finds he did do it. The question you're being asked is, would that be sufficient to establish a meaningful offer?
It may very well be, Your Honor, but he can't establish that he did do it. That's the issue. And
all
the
right.
burden is on them to establish that.
Right, I understand. I just want to narrow the issue. So
I mean,
the issue
if
what he normally did would be meaningful. The question is, did he do it in this case?
That's right. And my point to the court is, we'll never know.
At the beginning of your argument in chief, you indicated that there were two issues. One was whether the court found the facts correctly. And all of the your oral argument was really addressed to that question. But you also noted that there's a separate argument that the court applied the law incorrectly. What is that argument?
What I was speaking of, Your Honor, in terms of that argument is that I believe Judge Slates at the lower court level misapplied the law and custom and practice. He drew a distinction. This is an issue that we talked about between Mr. Redstone in this case, and the question was asked of Mr. Schock whether there was any evidence of the record where he talked about State Farm as custom and practice. In his deposition, there is evidence that he talked about State Farm's custom and practice as well as his. I would suggest there's no distinction. Under the Petilla case, I'd like to read to the court a passage regarding custom and practice that says, defendant's reference to the testimony of agent James J. Harstein, which obliquely refers to company policy of discussing increases in coverage with all clients, has to be fact-specific as to the communication of an offer to plaintiffs, and therefore unpersuasive in illustrating that an offer was made. In this case, the communication, I don't care if Mr. Redstone believes it was only his custom and practice and not that of State Farm's, he cannot be, because he doesn't remember it, fact-specific as to the communication of an offer to Ms. Purnell Charleston in this case.
Well, why isn't it possible to interpret that language to say that clears up any issue about whether company-wide practice, custom, habit, protocols, control, but it leaves open the question of whether an individual agent testifies that it is my practice, and I have no reason to believe I didn't do it on this occasion, although I don't have a specific recollection, to do the following, and then explains what they do. That language doesn't rule out fact-specific, meaning protocols specific to that individual agent as opposed to general company-wide policy. Does it?
The statement doesn't, Your Honor, but there's nothing in the record, nothing that the lower court considered to suggest, even based on an individual's custom and practice, if the court finds it was different in corporate level, there was anything fact-specific about his communication. There's no difference to the context. There's no difference to the person. It's the substance of the communication, and there's no difference.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement in recess.